Duncan Adams, welcome you to Late Night Live. And as regular listeners will know, we don't get too many right-wingers or conservatives on the program, not because they wouldn't be welcomed with open arms and heart, but because they all too often don't want to come on the program. And I have to admit that there aren't many conservatives who I really like, which is why when I meet one, I do. It's a real delight. And it was a pleasure to put the face to the voice of David Brooks at the Festival of Ideas in Adelaide last weekend. David had been on the program, and that had led to his invitation to Adelaide. He's a senior editor of the conservative Washington Journal, The Weekly Standard, a contributing editor at Newsweek, commentator on National Public Radio. He's been published in all the best US papers and journals, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The New Yorker, Smart Money, The New Republic, and Over the Pond by The Times Literary Supplement, to name but a few. He's the editor of the anthology Backward and Upward, The New Conservative Writing, and is currently writing a book on the manners and morals of the information age elite. We grabbed David between sessions at the festival, and before asking him to expound on his theory of big picture republicanism, I chatted with him about Rush Limbaugh. He told me previously that while Limbaugh was given a lot of credit for the Republican resurgence, the shock jock is now pretty much talking to himself.
Well, I wouldn't say that. He's got a big audience, but his influence on politicians and the broader culture is minimal, I would say. He turned out to be a one-note Johnny. His note was that we need more freedom. We've got this meddling bureaucrats who are coming down on us and getting into our lives. And he was very good at exploiting fears of that. I think the tide turned against that in the general zeitgeist with the Oklahoma City bombing, which was a bombing of a federal building. And suddenly the idea of attacking government people, government officials and government in the sort of virulent way that he had been doing it, people were scared by it. And it's happened across the country that suddenly people don't have that sense of anger anymore. So he goes on doing his program to millions, to 18, 26 million a week. But it doesn't affect the larger politics quite as much, except on specific issues. And there are some issues where he's very sophisticated and has actually got something done. There's a very arcane matter called a discharge petition, which has to do with when a bill can get out of a congressional committee. And there was sort of an anti-democratic thing that allowed congressmen to sort of evade public opinion. He launched a crusade against it, and he got it destroyed. So in that sense, I think he was effective on this very specific thing. But I would not say he's a force generally anymore.
You argue that in effect a conservatism that relies on populism, on resentments, rather than informing people's hopes, will ultimately fail.
Yeah, I think if I had to stretch the mega thing that's happened to the right in America, and the left actually, it is in 1994 the issue was freedom. That was the key word people wanted, whether it was freedom from government officials, freedom from something else. The Oklahoma bombing, and especially the rise of the stock market and the tremendous affluence of America, has people no longer feel their freedom is under threat. What they feel is anxieties of affluence, that they are losing control of their lives, losing control of their children's lives in particular. So the key value these days is control. It's not getting government off your back. It's help using government to give you control over your kids, control over smoking, control over the internet, control over guns. So the whole zeitgeist has changed.
But have your fellow conservatives caught up with this?
Some
reading
have.
The attacks on you, I would have thought that they hadn't.
Yeah, well, the article you refer to was 3 or 4 years old. And what we said was that how can you love your country if you hate your government? And we attacked the Republican Party for going into virulent anti-government mode, which was the Rush Limbaugh epic. But the Republicans have lost so many legislative battles since then. They have been intellectually hollowed out. And now they are for using government. They are positive about government again. So in that small sense, I think our side that we were arguing for has come back into fashion. And the person who best exemplifies this is the person who will probably get the Republican nomination for president, George W. Bush.
But he's appropriating some Democrat territory, isn't he, in much the same way that Clinton appropriated Republican.
Yeah, well, I think one of my lines is that Democrats steal Republican ideas and Republicans steal Democratic emotions. And one of the things George W. Bush has made as his centerpiece is this phrase, compassionate conservatism. And nobody knows what that means.
Well, we do know that a few years ago, the term compassion had to be removed surgically from the conservative lexicon.
Right. Compassion was a synonym for big government. But he has distanced himself from the anti-government feeling by saying we can use government in a limited way and in a compassionate way to help the inner cities. If there is an essence to it, it is God. It is the idea that the people in the inner cities, that faith-based charities can come in there and do things that government cannot do. And government should do whatever it can to help religious movements come in and help people in that sense. And that is a softer and a much more positive message than any Republican has had for 5 or 6 years. And the people look to George W. Bush as a savior. A friend of mine who was a state legislator in the Midwest went down to Texas and had lunch with Governor Bush. He was asked, well, what'd you have for lunch? And he said, oh, I don't remember the meal. I remember the man. The people have gone gaga over this guy. Mm. They don't know too much about him, but they know he probably will win the presidency, and they are just in love with him.
I was sitting in Galbraith's study at Harvard a couple of weeks ago talking to him about the Republican ascendancy, and he was talking about Reagan as the greatest of Keynesians, which reminds us that, and there's some truth in that, and it reminds us that Republicans weren't always against big government. They might have said they were.
Well, they were in the 50s. There are a lot of old things coming back in the Republican Party. The most ominous to me is the isolationism of Taft. The Republican Party reacted very strongly against our efforts in Kosovo, I would say in the main. It was split, but in the main. And my magazine was very supportive of the president, very supportive of the NATO action. And it was just pure return to isolationism. I went to a dinner that was sort of conservatism of the century. It was sort of look back on a century of conservatism in Washington. And there were people who were attacking Eisenhower, who were attacking Franklin Roosevelt for lying us into war. It was like I'd gone back in time. And these old things that were submerged in the Cold War because we had to be involved in the world to fight communism, they're all back. And that's another challenge the Republican Party is going to have to face.
Of course, it's very hard to get a grip on something as dynamic as American politics, particularly when you change one factor in the multifactorial equation and everything changes. And I'm thinking that there will be a stock market bust at some point. What will that do?
You've just scared me.
You can ring your broker later.
You predicted it. I'm worried. That I think that will actually help the Republican Party. There are two ways to spend yourself out of a recession or to have government address a recession. One is to big government spending programs, sort of the old-fashioned Keynesian, and the other is tax cuts, stimulus, through that form. I think there are very few Americans who support big government spending programs anymore. So I think if there is a recession...
That debate is over.
I think essentially so. I think Bill Clinton ended it. Bill Clinton's effect on the Democratic Party is revolutionary. Not so much on the country, but on the Democratic Party, it's absolutely thorough. And he started in the beginning of his administration with a big government spending program, a stimulus package, he called it. It was destroyed by Democrats. They're not going to go down that road again. So if there's a recession and you look to government to get us out of the recession, tax cuts are going to be the way to do it. Both parties will promise tax cuts, and the Republicans win that kind of bidding war.
You are, in a sense, a big spender in another way. You want a large investment in hope, in almost a spiritual dimension to conservative politics.
Yeah, to describe where I am, there is a strain of the Republican Party, which is mostly dormant except for me and a few of my friends, which starts with Alexander Hamilton. And it was a debate that Alexander Hamilton had with Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson believed in states' rights and limited government. Hamilton believed in government that would encourage competition and capitalistic energy. And the Hamilton tradition went through the Lincoln, it went through the Whig Party, went through the Republican Party in the 19th century, and it went most famously through Teddy Roosevelt. And then it sort of died. And I think
did it
can
die,
be
or is it simply dormant?
Well, I think it's dormant. I think it comes back periodically. I think it came back in the Republican Party in the 50s. The two prongs of this conservatism are, first, national union. Do things to unite the country, whether it's uniting them with railroads, uniting them culturally, in education, things like that. And the second thing is economic dynamism, to keep America a superpower. And that is stimulating the economy.
Well, given that American dynamism is painfully apparent for the whole world to behold, you are the only superpower, that isn't enough. That isn't enough to hold the country together. You still need to lift your sights.
Well, I think so, because America, and both on the left and right, are extremely ambivalent about our superpower status, don't like to acknowledge it or play with it. I shouldn't use the word play so lightheartedly.
That's one of the things we like about you, David. You're actually an amusing conservative.
Well, don't ask such deep questions. I'll tell more jokes. America is detached from public life, very anti-political. I'm for skepticism of government. I'm a conservatism, but skepticism has turned into a
cynicism.
Exactly.
And there's a huge difference, and people don't begin to understand not the other.
And it freezes political action of left or right, and it just it's just destroying our public life, actually.
Who are the better big-picture presidents, in your view? You've mentioned Roosevelt as the final embodiment of the ethos, but there would have been a few Democrats as well, wouldn't there?
I would say Franklin Roosevelt also had this view. I think Kennedy, actually, because Kennedy succeeded in doing was, he came at the end of an anti-political era, which the 1950s, a post-war anti-political era. We are in another post-war, Cold War, anti-political era. What Kennedy was able to do was, even in an age of prosperity, to explain why people should pay attention to public life, to explain what America's purpose in the world, fighting communism, fighting for freedom, helping human rights abroad, and he was able to mobilize the country. No one is able to do that right now, and we need a figure like that.
One of the mechanisms that profoundly affects Australian politics, which the voters, I don't think, are sufficiently aware of, is the pre-selection process. It's where the three Tammany Halls actually choose their candidates. This is also still very important in the US, and I was watching it during the attempts to impeach Clinton, where many Republicans were forced to go down that track, even though they didn't want to, because they were fearful, in effect, of pre-selection or holding their place. Now, that seemed to come out of the Christian right. Please tell me that they're now in retreat along with Rush Limbaugh.
They're not in retreat. I think they are not. They've become extremely pragmatic. Their main issue, as you know, is abortion. The leaders of the abortion movement are working with George W. Bush to submerge abortion as an issue, which is a level of pragmatism almost unheard of for any activist group. And they are doing it. And one thing I should say...
Have they cut a deal with him, which means that when you're president, you'll be our boy?
They just know it's impossible to pass the sort of constitutional amendment they would like. And so they're biding their time. One thing I always like to say, especially abroad, is that evangelical Christians get a bad rap in many foreign correspondents. I don't know how Australian foreign correspondents...
Yeah, we give them a very bad rap as far as we possibly can.
But let me correct a few misconceptions. One of the suggestions is that they are sort of poor, uneducated, wanting to roll back Darwin and fight the Scopes trial all over again.
And they do all over the country.
No, that's not true. Maybe the Scopes trial.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. If you do a study of who evangelical Christians are in the U.S., they have more university degrees than the population at large. They are richer than the population at large. They start businesses more than the population at large.
That makes them even more terrifying.
And they have more
sex
than the population.
They don't.
As a demographic group, they claim to have the most satisfying sex lives of any group in the U.S., and I believe it because they're married, and married people have better sex lives than non-married.
Can you demonstrate that with a research
study? Not right here.
Okay, so they're changing tactics, they're becoming more sophisticated, and we've got the wrong anyway. Now,
They'd love your program.
When you came out with the theory that the Republican Party needed to provide hope rather than merely be a party of negativism, you were torn to shreds by your own side of politics.
Yeah, as I said, the main thing that got people's ire was saying that it was not enough to be anti-government, and that, as I said, that how can you love your country when you hate its government? Especially true in America. We didn't start as a blood and soil country, as a monarchy. We started as a democracy. That's why America came into being. And that, as I say, in 1994, 95, and even 96, that was the high moment of Jeffersonianism, of libertarianism. Republicans were suspicious of the FBI, for God's sakes. Republicans used to be the Law and Order Party, but they have become so anti-government, they were suspicious even of the Law and Order. And that libertarian high moment has passed. And now the idea of government as a nurturing force is a force that can be used, not in a liberal way, but can be used in a conservative way, in a positive way, is back in favor. And I think if we wrote that article today, it would be uncontroversial.
Quite recently, we had a Labor government. in its last incarnation, was headed by a Prime Minister called Paul Keating. Keating was a big picture guy, and he went to the voters with the biggest of big pictures: Aboriginal reconciliation, a republic, a new relationship with Asia. Paul Keating loved policy, but he liked it on an epic scale. He was, in fact, doing a form of your idea of American greatness. He paid the heaviest of prices at the polls. He was wiped out by people who didn't want to know about big picture. They wanted the hip pocket policies. Here you are postulating the notion of American greatness. The words of Galbraith ring in my ear. He worked, as you know, for Stevenson's campaign, and he said, I led or helped lead Stevenson to disaster because I believed that America wanted big picture politics and they didn't want to know about it. He said, we were talking to ourselves, the intellectual elites. Isn't there a danger you're doing that?
Yeah, well, I'm a young guy and I can wait. Basically, America today is a country that is sick of culture wars, that is sick of big government, I mean, of big politics and big policies. This is a country which has embraced sort of some creativity, bohemian values, as well as the market. They want an end to culture wars. They want an end to... They're in a radically anti-contentious phase. If you offer them a fight, they run away from you. And if you offer them a challenge, they run away from you because, hey, you know, we play baseball. Our kids are playing Little League baseball. My kids play it every night of the week, and it's really fun to go to the games. And anything that's away, that takes me away from that, that is sort of angry or radical or not civil, I don't want to hear about it. That is the attitude that prevails in America today. That anything big, anything challenging, anything very political, people have become, they don't look to politics as a way to for their personal identity. They don't look to politics as solutions. They do politics if they do it at all, and they rarely do it. They do it sort of with vague hopes that we won't muddle things up too badly.
I have to say that I think you're right. I found this even in Harlem, with the young in Harlem. They're not being recruited by the political activists. They're too busy making a quid. They want to opt out of the argument.
And the politicians who succeed in such an environment are weavers. They weave together ideas of left and right, sometimes into an irreconcilable fudge. And it drives people on the left and right crazy because in America, it's hard to tell who's on left and right anymore. But the left, they like the 60s, and the right likes the 80s. I mean, that's the simplest way. And the people in the 60s see their symbols, Jack Kerouac, he's 50s, but the hippies, the hippie movement, sort of corrupted by commercial corporations, Abbie Hoffman used by, Nike or something like that. And the 80s, people who love the 80s see hippie and bohemian values sweeping through politics. And each side is enraged by this center force, which fudges everything together. And so they attack it from left and right. The center force, the reconcilers, the bohemian and the bourgeois, the people who have mixed it all together, they don't fight back. They just follow the advice of their throw pillows, which is living well is the best revenge.
It's one of my favorite T-shirts. here you come, waving a banner, American greatness. How do you want Americans to understand greatness?
Well, there are two basic prongs. The first is foreign policy, and we go back to a speech Teddy Roosevelt gave about 100 years ago almost exactly, where he said, nations remind themselves of their highest ideals with their foreign policies. And when they pursue a foreign policy, America was based on the idea that we're a democratic country, that these are universal values, and that we should promote them. That's why my magazine was so supportive of the Kosovo action, because we believe that that's America's job. That's how Americans remind themselves of what their best ideals are. We're also against free trade with China for the same reason, though our proprietor, who is Rupert Murdoch, takes a different view, but he's never meddled with us. And so we campaign quite aggressively against free trade with China because they don't live up to democratic ideas, and we think America needs to have an aggressive foreign policy.
Now, let's look at the local aspect of American greatness, the internal aspect. How is this perceived? How is it felt?
Well, I think, again, what America has to do, America's task, like so many other countries, is to reform the welfare state. Not to get rid of it, not to destroy departments, but to modernize it. To modernize our Social Security, our pension system, to modernize our school system in particular. One of the most exciting things that's happening in America today is the way the school system is changing. We have a system called charter schools, which are public schools, but which are totally independent. They're just given a check, and they can do whatever they want. And that is revolutionizing education around the country.
And are controlled by the parents?
They're controlled by the parents. The parents or the teachers both get the charter, and then the state gives them the money, and they do whatever they want with some supervision. Supervision.
This allows innovation to occur.
This allows tremendous innovation. It's extremely successful. This is true of many issues in the United States. Extremely successful with blacks. The problem with our gridlock is the policies that are supported by Republican politicians are supported by Democratic constituencies and vice versa. Because many of inner-city blacks are stuck in just terrible, terrible schools. Charter schools offer a way out, and many are taking advantage of it. But it's this sort of reform, and even more radical educational reform, that I think can, you know, move America forward, get America a better educational system, as long as you marry it to sort of national tests and national standards, so America doesn't, you know, balkanize, so we have a sense of common national knowledge.
You're one of the few conservatives I've met, talked to, who doesn't want to completely obliterate the welfare society, the welfare state. You want to modernize. What do you want to do to it?
Well, we've had our big welfare reform. Bill Clinton signed a bill, which is our welfare reform bill, which made it much more difficult to stay on welfare without trying to get work. When he signed it, there was sort of a big hullabaloo that it was going to create chaos in the streets. In fact, it's worked out moderately well.
But it's coincided, of course, with an economic boom.
Absolutely true. It was a good timing. But I think immediately 30 or 40% of the people on the rolls in these states went off because they were working in the underground economy, and once it became a hassle to collect welfare, they'd stop doing it. The other 34%, 30 or 40, you know, got work. They're struggling for them, but it's a step forward. And then there are the remainder who are going to stay on welfare because they, for a variety of reasons, they have trouble working in the economy. Maybe they didn't have the right culture, the right background, different disabilities. So you can't leave those people. What both parties want to do, both Al Gore and George W. Bush talk about this, is to increase the power, as I said, of faith-based charities, of private religious institutions. The idea is that government can come in and say, don't be a drug addict, get work. And, you know, there's some power in that. You know, I should lead a productive life. But if a preacher comes in and says, respect your body, you're part of God's world, I'll offer you eternal salvation. That's a little more beef.
Well, it doesn't play with atheists, but it does pretty well with
them. America's a tremendously religious country.
Yes.
I mean, one of the amazing things that's happened, you go to these Republican think tanks, there's a big one called the Heritage Foundation now, and there's meeting after meeting where people come in and tell you how they were converted to the faith, they turned their lives around, they stopped using drugs, they got off welfare, their lives have been turned around, people are just weeping. You know, I don't usually go to the Heritage Foundation and start weeping. I was at one meeting.
You'd start laughing
at
that point.
Yeah, I saw all these people crying, and I thought to myself, I haven't seen so many Republicans crying since the stock market crashed. I mean, it's sort of a transformation, but at the moment, this is yet another wave of how to address our poverty problem, and we're in the optimistic stage where we think it'll work, so don't burst our bubble.
One of the things the world loves about America, one of the very few things where America is unchallenged, or was unchallenged, is symbolized by the Statue of Liberty. Those huddled masses yearning to be free, the open arms to the world. It was a pretty unhappy arrival at Ellis Island, but, you know, God help us, it worked. The tide has turned against the Statue of Liberty.
Well, I wouldn't. It's debatable which way it's turned. I mean, even in my few days here, I've come across signs of an immigration argument that parallels.
It's happening here. It's happening a lot of places. Yeah. But it's astonishing that it's happening so powerfully in America.
But efforts to crack down on immigration tend to stall in the legislatures for some reason. There are constituencies for it. There are a lot of recent immigrants. We have gone through in the past 20 years a period of almost unrivaled. Our immigration levels have been higher than they have ever been in a century, at least. So there is a sense maybe we should take a break. But
so it's one thing to say we're closing the borders. It's another thing to do it.
The campaigns, when you campaign in Texas and you're a candidate for either party, one candidate says, I'm going to build a 12-foot-high fence to block out the Mexicans from coming. Then the next candidate says, 16 feet, 20 feet, 25 feet. But then nothing actually gets done.
So you're optimistic about the role of the Republican Party in the next century? You see it as regaining the ascendancy?
At the moment, I think both ideologies are just in crisis because we're in the age of the third way, and people who can be incoherent are the ones who succeed. But I think in the long run, you know, we won a great triumph in the Cold War. The people, when I go to Berkeley, Burlington, Vermont, the most left-wing cities in America, they're all capitalists. They love capitalism. I was in a cafe in Burlington, which has our only socialist member of Congress representing that town. And I was surrounded by people who looked like they just came back from Woodstock, tie-dye, everything, nipples, excuse me.
You can say nipples on Australian radio.
What a great country.
You can say penis or anything
okay,
you like.
Good,
really.
I'm going to take advantage of all this. What I meant to say is pierced, things pierced in all parts of their body. And yet, they're all launching these software companies. They're launching, you know, Putney Pasta. They're launching these fancy bread
companies. So they only look radical.
They look radical. They're great business people. And so there's no opposition to capitalism in America because the most left-wing people are the most businesslike.
Well, I must say, Berkeley is now a hotbed for attacking affirmative action, for example, isn't it?
Oh, that's true. And rent control, which was another great liberal thing in the 60s. And what's happened to these people? They grew up in the 60s. They watched The Graduate, and they heard plastics was a disaster. And now they're, you know, working for Silicon Valley, trafficking in plastics. And their attitudes were bound to change. They haven't become bourgeois right-wingers, but they've managed to merge 60s values with 80s values.
Well, with this sort of Republican Party, who needs the Democrats? Will they just close down and go away now?
Well, I think with the Democrats, who needs the Republicans? Because the Democratic Party has moved so sharply to the center. The idea of expanding government is out of the Democratic lexicon. The idea of privatizing the welfare state is in the Democratic lexicon. So there's very little, there's no left, there's a little right, and there's a huge muddled center in American politics.
I find this very disturbing because I've always hated conservatives, and I find I like you. I don't know what to do next, really.
I'm going about to kick you in the groin. That will help.
Thanks, David. You can say groin, too. That was David Brooks, senior editor of the conservative Washington Journal, The Weekly Standard, contributing editor at Newsweek, a commentator on National Public Radio, and currently my favourite conservative. You're listening to LNL on Radio National and Radio Australia.